Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Lavori. So glad you can join me where I am every week right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at annelagori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audioboom and iTunes. Support for this program comes from Travelers Championship, June 24th through the 28th, TPC River Highlands, TravelersChampionship.com for more information. I spent a gorgeous day playing Shinnecock in the U.S. Open media outing as Shinnecock Hills gets ready to host its U.S. Open Championship, its fifth U.S. Open Championship in the modern era. And guess what? I've covered the last four of them. I can't believe it. Way back in 1986, I was really just starting my career as a reporter, producer for ABC Radio Sports Network, and was able to get out to Shinnecock to watch Raymond Floyd win, and filed updates for the network and got interview tape, as we called it back then. Then in 1995, I did updates every 20 minutes for The Fan, WFAN Radio, on Corey Pavin's win in 2004. Still doing those WFAN updates every 20 minutes. In 2018, the updates on The Fan were at the top of the hour, and I was doing updates at the bottom of the hour for CBS Radio Network, and obviously throughout doing shows for this radio station. And then this coming June 18th through the 21st, I will be hosting Talking Golf and Sports Interview from Shinnecock during the U.S. Open and making various guest appearances. So it's been quite a history for me at the historic Shinnecock. I adore Shinnecock. There is no greater challenge in golf, personally. And, you know, I played Oakmont and I played Marion after the U.S. Open setups. Normally, I play the Monday after the U.S. Open. And I think those are the three most difficult U.S. Open courses, Shinnecock, Marion, Oakmont. Just such a challenge and such a joy to play all of them. One of my favorite places in all of golf is the historic Shinnecock Clubhouse, the iconic Stanford White Clubhouse, which he designed. They completed it in 1892. The back patio overlooks the rolling links-like layout of Shinnecock Hills. It's just such a stunning view. A large portion of the course is right before you. And you can also see the windmill at National Golf Links of America and the sprawling clubhouse at Sabonic in the background there from the Shinnecock patio view. And at the U.S. Open Media Day press conference, the USGA spoke about the club's great history, which I look forward to diving into more in a future show. They also talked about the setup for this year's U.S. Open. And, you know, since the controversial setups at Shinnecock in 2018 and before, the USGA has leaned toward a firm but fair approach. They're taking more of a hands-off approach this time around. They said they will lead the fairway with the way that it is at Shinnecock, and it will average about 48 yards, which is the widest fairways ever at a U.S. Open at Shinnecock. The green speeds will run between 11.5 and 12 on the stimp meter. They will handle water management as needed based on weather, and it really is more of a hands-off approach, it sounds like, to course setup. Very different than how it was handled in previous U.S. Opens there. As, you know, they got a lot of criticism for, you know, greens that really became unplayable. And, you know, players complained and it really took over kind of the news, which was too bad. But anyway, as I mentioned, as we get closer to the U.S. Open at Shinnecock, we will devote an entire show or two to the subject. Recently, I had the opportunity to play in the Gary and Vivian Player Foundation Golf Tournament, which included a gorgeous dinner at the Floridian Club in Stuart, Florida, And then their charity golf outing was the next day at Apogee Golf Club, just a gorgeous facility in Hope Sound. They have three 18-hole golf courses, a 7-hole par 3 course, a performance center, a driving range that is a 360-degree extravaganza. The clubhouse is stunning. That just opened in December. It's just simply spectacular. And I understand that another clubhouse is on the way. So the Floridian and Apogee, both clubs are just spectacular settings for any event. But this tournament is special. The legends who support this event that Gary Player hosts are off the charts. I mean, Gary Player himself, 90 years young, still going strong, God bless him, nonstop in his support for others, and his foundation's initiative called PLAE, P-L-A-E, Player Academy of Excellence, just transforming the lives of children and families living in poverty. And I had the pleasure of interviewing Nancy Lopez and Gary Player together. I've interviewed them many times separately through the last couple of decades. But what a joy to talk to them both right after the golf in front of the audience there. Nancy Lopez, winner of 48 titles, winner of 3 majors, Hall of Famer. She's been encouraging female golfers and male golfers of all ages for decades. Bernard Longer was there, another Hall of Famer, 47 wins, 2-time Masters champ, the all-time wins leader on the PGA Tour champions. It just had so much fun playing. They each were on a par 3 hole and made a dazzling birdie putt off of a Gary Player tee shot on one of the par 3s. And he got down on his knees as if he was, bowing to us. It was so funny. One of my playing partners, Jenny Pate, the daughter of Jerry Pate, U.S. Open champ, U.S. Open amateur champ, players champion as well. She made the birdie too after I made it, and it was just so much fun. Gary just loves when other people do well. There is so much joy and enthusiasm in him, and so this event that his daughter Amanda organizes is just spectacular. And I also made the birdie putt on the Bernard Longer tee shot too. So it was really a fun day. I'm so happy for Nelly Korda, who won the first major of the year on this season's calendar for the ladies, the Chevron Championship at Memorial Park in Houston, Texas. And then the very next week, Nelly Korda won the Riviera Maya Open at Mayakoba. The 27-year-old from Bradenton, Florida, is just on a roll. She has finished second or tied for second or better in all 6 of her starts this year. Just lovely to hear. In this show, you will hear my conversation with Grant Boone. He's the play-by-play voice of the LPGA for the Golf Channel. And we talk all about Nelly Korda's major win and the impact that she is having in women's golf. Hey, it's great to see Cameron Young continue to win. The 28-year-old from Scarborough, New York, he won the Cadillac Championship at Doral after winning the Players' Championship in March. And I thought he would win the Masters this year as well. And he ended up finishing tied for third, but what a season so far for Cameron Young. And you have to love the Fitzpatrick brothers. Matt Fitzpatrick has been on a roll as well, winning 3 of 4 events that he has played. His latest, the Zurich Classic. At New Orleans, he won it with his younger brother, Alex, the team event. Alex caddied for his brother years ago and, before Alex started playing internationally. And Alex winning the Hero Indian Open this year, the 2023 British Challenge. And thanks to Alex and Matt Fitzpatrick's win at the Zurich Classic, Alex has earned full PGA Tour status through the end of 2028. So great, great story for Alex. Many people have been asking me my thoughts on LIV Golf, and I have been voicing my opinion and talking about LIV on my show since LIV's inception back in 2022. And these last few weeks, we have learned that the Saudis Public Investment Fund, which has invested more than $6 billion into LIV since its launch, will stop funding the league after this 2026 season. So obviously, you know how I feel. I mean, LIV Golf, in my opinion, has totally disrupted the sport. But the uber wealthy Saudi sovereign have realized perhaps that the billions they have poured into LIV has not provided the return financially anywhere near what they were hoping for. But I think their strategy for doing LIV has been completely different. And we will take a deep dive into how I think LIV has won from a disruptor strategy and from, you know, promoting Saudi strategy, but certainly it was never viable or sustainable financially. We will discuss all of this in detail with Brandel Chambly, lead analyst for Golf Channel and one of golf's most respected, insightful, and provocative voices. Welcome back to Talking Golf with Ann Liguori, and congratulations to Nelly Korda, who won her third major title, a wire-to-wire win at the Chevron Championship, the first major of the season. The win moved her back to the top of the Rolex Women's World Golf Rankings for the first time since August of 2025. And joining me now to talk about the impact of Nelly Korda's win is Grant Boone. He is one of the most respected voices in golf. He is the play-by-play host for LPGA tournaments on Golf Channel, sports broadcaster for NBC, CBS, ESPN. Grant, you do it all. Welcome back to Talking Golf.
What you need to add to there, friend of Ann Liguori. That's like, that's up there at the very top.
You're very kind. It's always a pleasure to connect with you. And boy, what a win for Nelly Korda, wire to wire, Grant Boone.
Yeah, it was amazing to watch. And I go back to the very first hole on Thursday. This is the first major. And of course, a lot of your listeners will remember this event. So many do, as the Dinosaur that started back in the California desert, Rancho Mirage in 1972. And it evolved for 50 years there, became really the home of women's golf in a lot of ways. It was their Masters. Then Chevron came in, based in Houston, pumped a ton of new money into it. They've tripled the purse. But part of that means they want to have it in their backyard. So they bring it to Houston. 3 years at one venue called the Club at Carlton Woods. Nelly won there, 2024. Then they moved it here to Memorial Park, which is where the PGA Tour plays its Houston Open. So no one really knew the golf course on the women's side of things. And here comes Nelly. She had a win, which was a little strange. You'll recall it was back in Orlando when it was literally sub-freezing, below 32 degrees for the whole weekend there in the mornings, and barely got to maybe even 40 on those couple of days on the weekend. They canceled the final round. It was weird. It was unfortunate. And I think some people, Annie, may have thrown a little shade that hit Nelly. They really were saying, why didn't the LPGA play on Monday? And some of that shrapnel may have hit Nelly Korda, like, well, hey, it was only a 54-hole win. She didn't control any of that. She shot 64 in that third round, which is unbelievable. And then she comes here after 3 second-place finishes. And so you say, okay, Nelly's number two in the world, but she looks kind of like number one, and she looked like it all week. Very first hole, makes about a 5-footer for par. Off she went, bogey-free, 65, led by at least two after every round. And you know this, it's every single player in golf on any level would love to have a huge lead. It means they're playing great. It means they've got a little bit of wiggle room. And yet, what do we see? We've seen it with Rory. We've seen it with just about everybody. Big leads are hard to play with. Why is that? Players tell me, because only one result is now acceptable. I have to win.
That's right.
If I don't win, I've screwed up. Well, Nelly was impervious to all of that. She led by 6 going into the weekend. She led by 5 after round 3. She won it by 5. She looked like a dominant player in the world, which she is. And now, as you noted earlier, she's back to number one in the Rolex rankings. You don't Remember Scotty at the PGA last year? He goes out at Quail
Sure.
Hollow, and you thought that's the best player in the world going out, taking this tournament kind of, around the neck and saying, I'm not letting go no matter what happens. That's what Nelly did.
Well, a lot of pros, Grant, will say they don't want to be really in the lead by that much going into the final round. Padraig Harrington likes to be behind maybe by one or two shots. A lot of people think that pressure is just insurmountable. But Nelly was able to deal with that. She's really dealt with a lot. When you talk about the criticism after she won, the Hilton Grand Vacations Tournament of Champions in January, because it was shortened to 54 holes because of that incredible cold we've had in the Orlando area, early in the year. And there were reverberations about that she had to deal with. And then she was winless last year after having that incredible season in 2024. These athletes have to deal with so much criticism these days with all the social media and all the ways that people can verbalize, criticism. But I tell you what, she has really shown a lot of mental fortitude, and along with an incredible golf game, she's so beautiful to watch. But mentally, Grant, what she's had to deal with, everybody wants her to win. She's kind of like the face of the LPGA Tour here in
There's
the
no
United
question.
States, right?
There's
So she's
no
really had
question.
a lot of layers that she's had to deal with.
There's no question. And I do think that if you want to compete on this level in any sport, and I think you've talked to probably the best athletes and coaches in every sport, every halfway popular sport on the planet. You've heard this from them. It's part of the job. There's one way to have no one talk about you, and that's either not go pro or not be very good. We don't talk about most players the way we talk about Rory or Scotty or Jordan Spieth. When's he going to find his game again? Guess what? That means he had a game that we all wanted to see. I think the best players know, even though they don't like it, they know it's part of the equation. If you're going to play at the highest level, by the way, she won 1 point, what, $2 million. It was a $9 million purse. That's part of the equation. If you're going to be on this level, you've got to deal with that. That's why she talks about her bubble. She's saying, I'm st she, that's the term she uses. I'm staying inside with my team. It's a very tight circle. So think about her parents, Peter Korda, Regina. Peter won the Australian Open in 1998, tennis. Regina played tennis in the Olympics for Czechia, Czech Republic, that Czechoslovakia back then. Sebi Korda, terrific, one of the best American tennis players going right now. Jessica Korda, her older sister, six-time LPGA Tour winner. She's got the same caddy she's had for all 10 years on tour. She's got the same trainer, same coach, David Whalen, who was her coach when she started playing the game. So, Annie, I think that is her antidote to that sickness that may try to sneak in, or that virus that may try to creep in of criticism. Stay in the bubble, stay protected, don't listen to the outside noise. You do what you want to do. And I think she's also talked about, to your point, about the winless season last year. By the way, her scoring average last year, lower than
Wow.
when she won seven times in 2024. It wasn't as if she played poorly. She made every cut multiple times in contention. And she just said, I have had to learn to forgive myself a little bit. These great players, the best really in any field, sports or not, they're often their own worst critics.
Sure. They're so hard on themselves.
I think so. Yeah.
So, talking about that team, who all jumped in the pond with her after
Yeah.
she won to celebrate? And may I say, her cannonball was a perfect 10, if I'm going to judge
I
style
mean,
points.
in the words of our friend, my colleague Dan Hicks, expect anything different? Of course she's just put on this virtuoso performance. She's gonna nail the cannonball. She's a Florida kid. She gets it. She knows what it's like to nail the cannonball. She had her caddy Jason McDead. She had her trainer Kim. She had her agent Chris Mulhopp. She had her sister Jessica, her nephew Grayson.
Right.
She's Auntie Nellie, she says. And you know, for folks who remember the Dinah, Poppy's Pond, Amy Alcott,
right.
whom you've known for years, Amy jumped into the pond, first one to do it in 88. When Dinah Shore passed in 94, February of 94, Donna Andrews thought, let's revive that tradition to honor Dinah. Well, then pretty much everybody after that jumped into the pond. Well, they moved to Houston. The first course they were for 3 years had water by 18. So they put a little deck out there and players jumped in when they won. They didn't have water at this course. Memorial Park doesn't have water on 18. So the Chevron folks said, talking to a lot of the players, the current players are like, what do we do when if we win? They built this makeshift. I mean, it was all according to it was nice. It was not big, but it was big enough for
sure.
five people to jump in, plus a little Grayson. And it got a little bit of blowback on social when some people saw it. They thought it looked a little rinky dink or whatever. And I said, this is Chevron, who's done nothing rinky dink since they got the sponsorship of this event. They keep pumping resources, charity dollars, purse increases, and they listen to the players. They kind of, speaking of shutting out the noise, they were. I applaud them for risking the ridicule, as I said, of the drive-by critics, people who don't really matter, people who don't care. Just you know, people who are going to fire off some angry tweet. They listened to the players, and the player said, I don't want to be the one winner who doesn't get to jump, because next year they're actually, Tom Doak is going to put water in.
I read that.
So next year it won't be an issue, but think about this, Annie. You and I were just at the Masters, and that one event has probably a dozen traditions that you don't have to think of. You just green jacket, you
That's
know,
right.
White overalls for the caddy, or, you know, the women's game doesn't have many traditions. And when you think about the leap into Poppy's Pond, you can like it or not like it or think whatever you think, but it is the single most enduring tradition in women's golf. And I just think Chevron, took their own leap of faith and said, we're going to do this thing. We're going to do it. And we're going to do it for the players. And when you saw Nelly go full cannonball and the look on her face, you thought she nailed the cannonball. They got it right too. Good for Chevron.
I love that. And good. Yeah. Good for Chevron. I know the purse increase since they took
wow.
over as title sponsor this year, it was 9 million, up from 7.9 million.
It was 3.1 when they took over 4 years ago. 3.1.
Right.
Now it's nine.
9 million. And now you earned 1.35 for the win, up from 1.2 mil last year. I mean, everything about it seems first class. And I remember the criticism when they actually moved the championship.
Oh, yeah.
From
yeah.
Mission Hills in California, which we all love that
oh,
venue,
yeah.
right? And Amy Alcott starting, you know, the plunge into the pond back,
yeah.
as you mentioned, in 1988. We weren't sure if that tradition would even continue, right?
Yeah.
But
sure.
to see it now and to know that Tom Doak is going to, what, redesign the 18th green and
yeah.
and end the pond, I think is very important. And talk about the venue, because I understand Memorial Park, it's a municipal
it is.
Course. And so many people came. The spectators
yeah.
were of the younger demo, too, I understand.
Yeah. Yeah. Memorial Park, if you're a Houston resident, Monday through Thursday, so we're doing this on a Tuesday, you could play for $30.
I love
$30.
That.
Now, getting a tee time could be tough because
sure.
word is out. The Houston Open's been there. The men's Houston Open's been there since 2020. So they've got a little bit of tradition. They used to host the Houston Open back in the day, back in the 50s and 60s. Our dear beloved Judy Rankin won the only other LPGA event ever held there. It was in 1972. She beat Kathy Whitworth, eagle the last hole, then eagle the playoff hole to beat Whit. And it had that little bit of LPGA history as well.
And this season, how can it not be promising for Nelly Korda?
By the way, she's got 17 career wins. She's got 22 Hall of Fame points. And maybe for people who don't follow the LPGA, they may not know they have a points-based Hall of Fame. You win 27 points and you're into the Hall of Fame. You get 1 point for a regular season win, 2 points for a major. You get a point for player of the year, point for the Vaire Trophy, which is their low scoring average. And you get a point if you win a gold medal in the Olympics. So Nelly has 22 points. If I'm taking yes or no that Nelly will get to 27 points by the end of this year, I'm saying yes.
Grant Boone, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to catch up. Love your insight. Love your passion in supporting the women's game. It's
I'm the
so
lucky one.
important to come, not only from women, but from guys like yourself who are just, you are relentlessly passionate about the women's game and the
Thank you.
LPGA Tour. And
Thank
I just,
you.
we appreciate you so much.
Thank you, Annie. I love this tour. I've been doing it since 2000, and I'm the lucky one that I get to be out here and tell these great stories from players from everywhere.
Grant Boone, and tell your darling uncle, Pat, I send my love.
91 years young. You'll find him on Instagram.
I love him, Pat Boone. Anyway, Grant, thank you so much. Always enjoy it.
Okay, Annie.
The landscape of live golf has changed drastically and quickly these last couple weeks. The Saudi Public Investment Fund will stop financing LIV Golf after the 2026 season. Yasser Al-Rumayyan is stepping down as chairman of LIV Golf. LIV Golf is undergoing an overhaul, establishing a new independent board to guide the league. Investment bankers Gene Davis and John Zinman are leading the new board and will be bringing in expertise for restructuring and securing long-term capital. Boy, the numbers that have been reported by season's end, more than $6 billion will have been invested since LIV's inception in 2022. You know, financially, to me, it never seemed viable or sustainable from a return of investment perspective. However, it can be argued that LIV Golf did work in the following areas. LIV forced its way into the power structure of golf. It did not just enter the game, it disrupted the game. It pushed the PGA Tour into major structural and financial changes. It drove up purses and player compensation. It triggered negotiations and outside investments into the tour. It brought global attention instantly to Saudi Arabia, inserting the Saudis into the golf conversation as they signed top players and dominated headlines. It showed that loyalty can be bought. The questions now are, what happens to LIV and the players who made that jump? Joining me now is one of the game's most insightful and at times provocative voices, a lead analyst for the Golf Channel, Brandel Chamblee.
Always happy to talk to you, Anne. Absolutely. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Well, I was always opposed to LIV Golf. To me, it was simply a question of loyalty versus greed. How do you feel at this point with everything going on?
Well, everything you said there, and in particular, proved that loyalty can be bought. I would have to agree with it. It's certainly disruptive. It did throw the golf world into turmoil. Yeah, it did result in raised purses. That's what competition generally does. But I would think, more importantly, and more egregiously, and more far more of a concern, is it tilted the game towards greed, and perhaps irreparably so. It muddied the meritocratic waters of the game. It sort of turned what had always been the best aspect of golf, besides its philanthropic component, has always been. It was about merit, pure merit. For the most part, it was about, have you qualified? Why are you here versus somebody else? You have to make a cut. And it turned a competition into an exhibition. LIV was about selection, and the world saw through it. We don't have a lot of time every day to do all the things we got to do, and we watch sporting events that matter. And because it was clearly, transparently an exhibition, and because it was so transparently about sports washing, not about getting the best players in the world together, nobody thought that the Saudis really cared about golf. And it turns out that no matter how big the ruse, no matter how much money you throw at an idea, if it's a bad idea and it doesn't resonate, you're not going to get it out off the ground. So they were bleeding billions, and so it's going to be reorganized. And if it's not the Saudis' money, and they're not trying to launder their reputation, and it's another organic golf league, they're going to have a tough time of it though. And they probably need to restructure and rename it because LIV is such a toxic name in the game. Nobody's going to watch it if it's named LIV. If it goes back and restructures, as so many businesses have, renames and comes back, I just don't see how they're going to pull it off, though. The idea that the PGA Tour is a monopoly is ludicrous. There's a Japanese tour, an Australasian tour, an Asian tour, a Latin American tour, a South American tour, a DP World Tour, and scores of other tours. It's just that the PGA Tour is the best because this is where most of the money is that is willing to pay and align itself with the game of golf. It's where the best courses are. It's where the courses are in the best condition. And that's why everybody wants to come over here and play. So good luck to another tour trying to compete with that.
Well, talking about greed, do you think the stars that bolted to LIV were misguided? Obviously so, but were the agents to blame?
You raise a great point, and I don't think that the agents have gotten enough derision directed towards them. They're meant to look after the legacy of their players, the best interests of their players, and they wanted their 20% or 10% of whatever the Saudis were dishing out, a Niagara of money, and they wanted it. And in a lot of cases, they push their professional golfers in that direction, not caring about the legacy or, what would Ian Poulter's end of his career look like, or Lee Westwood's, or Henrik Stenson's, or for that matter, Phil Mickelson's. I'm not sure that you could have coerced Phil into anything other than what Phil thought. I think that the agents were to blame, but along those lines, there are plenty of good actors in this. Mark Steinberg didn't push his players towards it. I've jokingly said there should be a statue of Mark Steinberg right up in front of the PGA Tour headquarters because he, and I had a conversation with Mark Steinberg a couple of years ago at Valhalla during the PGA about that very subject. So not all agents did, but some of
Some of
them.
them.
And then, just a lot of players, when push came to shove, were happy to take those hundreds of millions after they had essentially lambasted LIV, like Jon Rahm.
Brianna, if the Saudis, with all their money, don't think LIV is viable, how are they going to convince investors to come in?
I don't know. I used to get that question all the time when I was criticizing LIV. The question would always come up. Like, it cracked me up that people would ask this question. Well, what if Australia was behind it? Or, what if a businessman were behind it? And I said, okay, sure. Then would I have a problem with it? No. But nobody in their right mind would have the business model of LIV. The reason they were willing to overpay and the reason they had to overpay is because everybody knew it was a ruse. It wasn't about golf. It was about, in a sense, paying tour players hazard pay because they knew it was going to damage their reputation and their legacy. And for that matter, their ability to compete at the highest level. So this would be a bit like, and I made this analogy, you run Mercedes. And this is where I think Jay Monahan gets unfairly maligned. You're the CEO of Mercedes. BMW decides to start giving away their cars for free. And you know what? Your sales are going to go down. They're going to tank at Mercedes. You can't compete with an irrational actor like that. Now, is the CEO of Mercedes to blame for that? That someone comes along who's completely irrational? Not in my estimation. So if somebody wants to take over this catastrophe that LIV is and try to make it work, good luck to them. They're going to waste billions of dollars and time and ideas because the legacy of the PGA Tour is important and the best tournaments in the world are here.
So now, what do you think the PGA Tour should do about potential pathways for these players who want to come back?
I think it'll be case by case. It depends on how involved the players were with the lawsuit against the PGA Tour and how long they sat on that lawsuit. Like Bryson DeChambeau sat on that lawsuit the entire time until it dissolved in June 6th. Okay. Phil Mickelson sat on that lawsuit. Phil Mickelson was recruiting players while he was an active PGA Tour player. He was recruiting players to live. To what extent they denigrated the PGA Tour on their way out, maybe how much money they made. Every one of them is going to have, I think, a rockier and more punitive road back than Brooks Koepka did. And Patrick Reed, even, who had to go back to the DP World Tour to qualify and try to work his way on the PGA Tour. Those two players left of their own will. Everybody else who's coming back is only coming back because LIV collapsed. So I don't think the road back is going to be as quick. They should go to the Korn Ferry Tour and have to play, or go qualify on the DP World Tour. And if they already have existing exemptions, okay, maybe they can come back and play the lesser PGA Tour events and have to earn their way back into the upper echelons of golf on the PGA Tour.
Brando, why do you think Jon Rahm was so hesitant in resolving his issues with the DP World Tour? I know that's been resolved recently, but why do you think it took him so long?
Because he lives probably in a little echo chamber where he believes he's right, and he thinks he's standing on principle when he violated the rules of the DP World Tour. Everybody else paid the fines to be considered for the Ryder Cup. It's a potential chaotic situation for the next Ryder Cup in Ireland. Because although I'll say this, John didn't play well when they played at Bethpage. He didn't play well. He wasn't last, but he was close to last on that team in terms of his contribution. And they still dominated the U.S. team. So I think Europe figured out that they can play well without Jon Rahm. And by the way, Jon Rahm's game has slipped such that he's no longer the player that he used to be. So he's not that integral to the success of the European team. And he certainly wasn't on foreign soil, and I doubt that he will be on more friendly soil. So, but he's going to have to pay tens of, not hundreds of millions of dollars if he wants to come back to the PGA Tour. It's funny. They were all paid hundreds of millions, tens of millions of dollars to go play for LIV. To come back and play for the PGA Tour, they're going to have to pay for the privilege, tens of hundreds of millions of dollars. And the juxtaposition of those two is that one was about sports washing and the other is just about competition. You want to be a part of this, you got to earn it.
What about Phil Mickelson? Do you think, and we haven't heard a peep from Phil Mickelson in a while now, but I wonder if he had to have seen the writing on the wall with all this live.
Maybe. I'm not sure what's going on with Phil. I wish him and Amy well. He's got an adorable wife, and Amy. Everybody loves her. I kind of miss Phil as a voice in the game. If Phil hadn't left for LIV, if he hadn't so heavily denigrated the PGA Tour, these people, by the way, they wanted to destroy the PGA Tour. They didn't want to compete alongside the PGA Tour. They wanted to destroy it. Phil Mickelson, Greg Norman, they thought they were smarter than the PGA Tour. So, Phil's, if he hadn't gone to LIV, Phil would have probably been the lead voice at CBS. He would have been an honorary starter at Augusta. He would have been doing corporate outings for millions of dollars. He would have made, and we've, Rich Lerner, myself, we've talked to people who are well versed in these things. He would have made 30, 40, $50 million a year for the rest of his life and would have been a very important voice in the game. And the self-immolation of his legacy by saying the things he said on the way out, I don't think he'll recover from that. And I don't think he'll find a way back to the PGA Tour.
It's such a shame, particularly after he won, the championship at on Kiawah Island. And oh my gosh, he was on such a high at that point, and his deep dive just was incredibly sad. The way the PGA Tour schedule is set up right now with these signature events, we're not seeing the best players in the world compete against each other, which is really what their ultimate goal was when they were kind of restructuring this tour. I mean, Rory's playing different events than Scottie Scheffler. It's because of the schedule and timing. And so I don't think the PGA Tour schedule is working either.
Well, the tour players all have autonomy. They can do whatever they want to do. They're not contracted to all show up at the same places at the same time. So if you've got, 100 odd players, it stands to reason they're going to have different schedules, different agendas, different things going on at home So one week is not going to work for a few players, and the next week is not going to work for a few more. But the idea that we need all the best players in the world playing together, I think, is misguided. If you go back to the 80s, all the best players in the world played in Europe. They did not play, they were not part of the PGA Tour. They did not play except majors. So you're talking about Nick Faldo, Bernhard Langer, Seve Ballesteros, Jose Maria Olazabal, Ian Woosnam, Sandy Lyle. These were all the best players in the world. And they played in Europe. And they came and played in the majors. And that's about the only time we saw them, in the majors and the Ryder Cup. You know what? The PGA Tour did just fine. So I'm a, and this is one of the ways when I say it's tilted the PGA towards greed. Now the best tour players have a ridiculous amount of power, power that they should not have. And the first thing they did is made the field smaller, reduced the number of cards, and took away the cut. Well, those are three things where you've guaranteed to deliver a product to the audience that is less competitive. The difference between the best player, Scottie Scheffler, and an average tour player is only about 3.5%. It's not like other sports where the difference is 20 or 30% between Tom Brady and the average quarterback in the NFL. It's 3.5%. Underdog stories matter in this game, they resonate. You have to keep those pipelines open. Fields should be at a minimum 120. At a minimum, they should be 120. They should be as large as you could possibly make them. There should be cuts. There shouldn't be 100 tour cards. There should be 125. Why did they just randomly reduce it from 125 to 100? Because they think they're making the tour harder. What they've done is they've guaranteed that it is less competitive. The landscape of golf should have plenty of room for people to move in and out. And of course, yeah, there will be relegation and promotion within smaller tours. But you've reduced the opportunity of underdog players to come in and disrupt the tour. The WGCs were a failure. They brought the best players in the world all together to play in big cities, and they were a failure. Why were they a failure? Well, because we saw the same players every week competing against the same players. There was no novelty in them. And Tiger Woods won half of them, more than twice his win percentage over the course of his career. His career win percentage is around 22%. In the WGCs, it was almost 50. So the world grew tired of them. And they, there was just no market for them. So these signature events, they sound good in theory, but I think they've irreparably tilted the game towards greed.
I was just going to ask you, do you think the players in golf now are making too much money?
Well, the market determines what they're worth, and there's been competition in the game of golf, and so this is what the market allows. I think now that LIV is off the table, and there's been pushback on this. I've heard that I've heard people say that there won't be a falling off of the purses, which is it's hard for me to believe, because I don't think that the current purses are sustainable given the ratings. Golf is a niche sport, and they're not going to draw. Okay, the Masters gets a big number, and then progressively less than the other majors, but they're not going to draw 20 million people to watch. They're not. They get 2, 3, 4 million, and that's a pretty good weekend. So I don't know how that the ratings justify these purses. I'm not sure how they're sustainable. They're certainly, I can't imagine that they would grow. There's got to be a leveling off of these purses. And the idea is that we're going to guarantee bringing the very best players in the world together. How are they going to guarantee it? They don't all show up every week. Who skipped last week? Rory, Xander Schauffele, Matt Fitzpatrick, and I don't think Scottie Scheffler's playing this week. They don't all show up because they're not contractually obligated to all show up, and there's no avenue to contractually obligate these players. They try to incentivize them with points and money. Doesn't work. The best players can play their 15, 16, 18 tournaments and get everything done they need to get done.
These signature events, Brandel, ultimately, it's really the sponsors that are taking the hit. I mean, $20 million in prize money, that's a big difference from
Well,
years
it's not
past.
just the prize money, it's the build out, and then paying for TV. I'm no expert in how these things get put on, but I listen to people talk about it's not just the prize money, it's upwards of 20, 25, 30, $35 million to put these tournaments on. And maybe for some of them, they can handle the losses, and it's worth the recognition and the alignment with the PGA Tour because it is an amazing product. It's one of the most enviable products and has the most enviable demographic in all of sport. So maybe they're willing to sustain those losses as sort of a loss leader to affiliate with the PGA Tour, and maybe that will be the case. You know, I've never understood, you know, from an economic position, how the Champions Tour makes it. But when you look a little closer to the Champions Tour, you realize that these are large corporate outings, and they quite enjoy the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday pro-ams and the alignment with the PGA Tour. So I can't imagine that too many of the Champs Tour events are hugely profitable, but they've been going now for 46 years.
And I'm sure they wish they were would be helped a little bit more by the PGA Tour and the monies coming into the PGA Tour,
Well,
the Champions PGA Tour.
that's part of you know, the emergence of LIV. All of a sudden brought questions about what are we going to do to shore up the PGA Tour, and it didn't happen. The Korn Ferry Tour is still alive and well, and there's a commitment by Brian Relap and his team, I think, to continue the importance of that. But I do believe the Champs Tour lost their retirement. You know, that went away. So again, the question comes, how do you pay for all of these things that the PGA Tour has been doing, and how do you still contribute to all of the necessary, the wonderful charities that the PGA Tour and their partners in all of these events where they run these tournaments? So PGA Tour says that they give X amount of dollars to charity. In that number are all these tournaments contributions. So the Thunderbirds give 18 million. Now, you could say that the PGA Tour provides the players and the Thunderbird provide the tournament. So they are in partnership together. They're all helping. But the WM Phoenix Open Thunderbirds, they give away about, well, it'll be over $20 million this year to charities in the Phoenix area. My big question is, since private equity now is such a big part of the tour, are they going to ask for a larger cut of that philanthropy? And what I'm hearing is, no, they're not going to. And if that's the case, that's great, because the philanthropy has always underpinned the tour.
Absolutely. Hopefully the charity component will stay because that's one of the greatest things about professional golf. Two more questions, Brandel. How would you like to see the PGA Tour restructured, the schedule in the future?
Well, I would have to give that some thought, Anne. I honestly don't see the problem with the PGA Tour. When people complain and say the PGA Tour need to reorganize, I'm like, really? Okay, what are you going to do? Are you telling me that 72 holes medal play is a bad way to decide a champion? The tour hasn't developed stars. I mean, Tiger Woods came along and dominated the game. It's the most compelling. Are we just having a post Tiger Woods hangover and say, since he's not playing anymore, we've got to somehow artificially manipulate the tour to where we have, you can't possibly recreate Tiger Woods and what he meant to the game. But in the, what have we had since then? Rory McIlroy, Jordan Spieth, Scottie Scheffler, Brooks Koepka. We've had incredibly compelling golf and figures come along. I was never buying the fact that there was something wrong with the PGA Tour. Never. Never did buy it. Still don't buy it. You know, you want to tell me where it's wrong? It gives an incredible amount of money to charity. We got a beautiful backdrop in our house and in our clubs and in our restaurants everywhere we go. They're playing somewhere every week, which this is a participatory sport. We don't watch golf like we watch every other sport. You watch football because, you know, you're from Philadelphia and you want to watch the Eagles and you got to bet on the game. Nobody's watching football thinking, I wonder if I could throw like that, or is my arm like Tom Brady's? Nobody's watching football or baseball thinking about their own football game or their own baseball game. But we watch golf for a myriad of reasons. One, we all play it and love it, so we're also trying to get better. And another, because we want to travel to wherever this tour event is the next week or the next year. And what's that like? And can we get our friends to go with us? And can we rub elbows with these tour players, et cetera, et cetera? There's a million reasons we watch golf. Maybe I'm in a small majority. I never saw any problem with the PGA Tour other than the Tour Championship. They've never figured out how to run how to get the perfect format for the Tour Championship. But nonetheless, golfers watch. You're not going to get other sports people to watch golf. And unless you tilt the game towards gambling, and my fear is that they're going to disproportionately tilt the game towards gambling like other sports so that they can increase the value in golf. And I think that would be incredibly short-sighted.
I agree with you. I'm a traditionalist. Let it be. my last question, how do you think this era in golf will be viewed in the broader history of the game?
I think we're very fortunate to have people in this era at the top of the game that we have. I don't know if there's ever been a player with as much generosity of spirit who's as great a player as Rory McIlroy in the game of golf. I mean, yeah, he's a bit like if you put Bobby Jones and Arnold Palmer together, because Rory's a very smart. Very smart guy, incredibly aware, incredibly socially aware, self-aware, and generous. I mean, his run-up to the Masters doesn't get enough credit. He was there, he was doing all the right things. He was on site for the Augusta National Women's Amateur, did all the interviews on site for the DCP, did all the interviews Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, arguably gave the greatest ever champions dinner. And then went out and won the golf tournament. I think we're very lucky to have Rory. We're very lucky to have Scottie Scheffler at the top. We're very lucky to have Xander Schauffele. We're very lucky to have Shane Lowry. We're very lucky to have Matt Fitzpatrick. We're very lucky to have Lydia Ko. We're very lucky to have Gino Titicun. We're lucky in that I think America's got another dominating star in the LPGA and Nelly Korda. I think this is an incredible era. Everybody's going to point and compare it to Tiger's era and say, we don't have that. Okay, guess what? I watched the Kentucky Derby this weekend and Secretariat didn't win. And the horse that did win, Golden Tempo, I think would have been like 10 lengths behind Secretariat. There's never going to be another Secretariat. There's never going to be another Tiger Woods. But we're pretty dang close. And not only are the golfers of this era phenomenal athletes, they're great to listen to and great stewards of the game. And so we're back with great stewards of the game at the top. So I think this is an incredible era.
I agree. Well said as usual. Thank you so much, Randall, for your insight. Really, I always enjoy talking to you.
Thank you, Anne. I really appreciate it. And congratulations to you for all you're doing in the game.
My thanks to Grant Boone, to Brando Chambly, and to Mike Goodsell in production. Support for this program comes from Travelers Championship, June 24th through the 28th at TPC River Highlands. TravelersChampionship.com for more information. As the great Winston Churchill once said, "We make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give." Have a great week, and I look forward to visiting with you next time on Sports Interview with Anne LaBorde.